We come in our study of the book of Genesis to the story of Joseph. Joseph had been thrown in prison unjustly because of a false accusation by his master's wife, Potiphar's wife. In the prison, he had interpreted dreams with God's guidance for a butler and a baker. And then word had gotten to Pharaoh from this butler about this, and Pharaoh was troubled by a double dream of his. The dream about the 7 fat cattle coming up from the river and being eaten up by 7 skinny cattle that followed them. 7 good heads of grain being eaten up by 7 ears or heads of grain that just didn't have any grain. And Pharaoh didn't know what they meant, this dream. His magicians couldn't help him, and so he sends for Joseph. And Joseph says to Pharaoh, God will give Pharaoh an answer. And he says, these dreams really have the same meaning. It speaks of 7 years of plenty, the fat cattle and the heads of grain loaded with food. 7 years of plenty are going to be followed by 7 years of famine. And then he says, Pharaoh, what you ought to do is put somebody in charge of this and gather grain during these 7 years of plenty so the folks won't starve to death when the famine comes. Now, Pharaoh is obviously convinced about the truth of this. And so he says, well, listen, Joseph, you're the one to be in charge of this. I'll still be the Pharaoh, but you are in full charge of everything in the country otherwise. And then Pharaoh's going to have Joseph married to a girl from a prominent family. Her name was Asenath. And there's going to be the story of the birth of Joseph's 2 sons, Manasseh. The word means God has made me to forget all my toil and my father's house. God's made me forget all the troubles I've been through. He was so happy to have this little boy. And then there was a second son, Ephraim, and his name means fruitful. All right, Joseph went through the land and made preparations in all the cities to store up a goodly portion of the grain during these years of plenty. You see, when God says there's going to be a famine, you look for a famine. When God said there was going to be a flood, Noah looked for a flood. When God says Jesus is coming back, you and I ought to be looking for the coming of Jesus. God knows the future. Oh, God knows all the details of the future. And so, Joseph made plans. One of the things that, it doesn't settle the matter, but I think so interesting. Down in Egypt, there's a big dam across the Nile River, and it goes, the water flows from this dam into a canal out to what's called the Fayum, one of the most fruitful places the archaeologists have ever found for digging up old manuscripts. You see, this water flows from the Nile out into the desert, and they've found all kinds of books and letters, things several thousand years old, and it's so dry that they haven't rotted at all. Now, the interesting thing is that this canal is named the Yusuf Canal. And there's no definite information about it, so far as we know, except this name. It would be the same as Joseph. Is this one of the canals that Joseph had made? Was this one of his big water storage projects? And we're not sure. There are so many thousands of things, I meant to say thousands, in archaeology that have been dug up that just show that the Bible is the Word of God. But I think this one's interesting maybe we'll hear something about it one of these days that's real definite and that ties it to the Joseph of this story. But the famine came, and it wasn't just in Egypt, it was up in the land of Canaan. And of course, the next thing in the story, it's Genesis 42, Joseph's 10 brothers, the younger brother Benjamin now still at home, the Joseph's 10 brothers come to Egypt to buy grain. And Joseph recognizes them. And of course, it's easy to see the picture. Here are these men with their faces to the ground. They're bowing before this great Egyptian. They're not thinking about their brother at all and not looking for him. And he speaks to them through an interpreter. And so they don't know to whom they're really speaking. He recognizes them. And then he asks them about their family. He accuses them of being spies. Now, Joseph's not going to do anything bad to them, but he wants them to face up to what they've done. And so he says to them finally, well, yes, I'll let you have some food. You go back and you told me you had a younger brother. You bring him with you next time, then I'll know you're telling the truth and that you really didn't come down here just to be spies on my land. And these brothers are talking with each other in Hebrew, not realizing that Joseph, standing close by, understands every word of their Hebrew. Again, he's dressed by this time as an Egyptian, and they have their faces to the ground. They don't recognize him. But they are saying to each other, we are very guilty. We saw the anguish of his soul, our brother, when we sold him, maybe 20 years earlier, something like that. And it's still on their hearts and minds. They haven't forgotten. And Joseph said, well, I'll keep one of the brothers, and he keeps Simeon, until they come back with the younger brother and prove that they're telling the truth. Joseph knew all the time they were telling the truth. He's testing them. Now, they report back to Jacob in the promised land, and Jacob is crushed. He said, all these things are against me. All these things are against me. I've lost Joseph, and now you've left Simeon in Egypt. And so he doesn't want anybody to go back to Egypt for a while. After some months or weeks have gone by and the food is used up, Judah says, listen, I'll be responsible for Benjamin. This man said he wouldn't let us see his face unless we brought our younger brother. And so Jacob finally agrees to his going to Egypt. Well, they come down to Egypt, 11 brothers now. You see, 10 have come back, and one was already in prison, Simeon. And Joseph seats them according to their age. He seats Reuben, then Simeon, Levi, and so on, according to the order in which they were born, and they were amazed. He knew which one was which, but he still hasn't told them who he is. He does ask them about your father, and they tell him our father as well. And after this meal, Joseph sends them back, all 11 of them, but he has their money put back in their grain sacks and his cup, his personal cup, to be a gold cup, you would think, put in Benjamin's sack. And after they get going, here come the policemen, and they say, hey, how come you robbed Pharaoh's palace, and how come you ran off with our master's cup? And they said, we didn't take anything. We brought back the money that you put in our sacks wrongly the first time we were here. Why would we want to steal anything? And they find the cup when they search in Benjamin's sack. Benjamin didn't know it was there. And so they're taken back. And at this point, you have one of the brothers, Judah. making a plea. He said, listen, let my little brother Benjamin go home and just keep me instead. This is the same Judah who 20 or so years earlier had said about Joseph, let's sell him. No, it's not the same Judah either. He's grown up. He's grown up. He's come to the place now where he doesn't want to hurt his father that much. And he's willing to stay himself and be a prisoner or a slave. But please, let my brother go. And then Joseph makes himself known. Joseph tells them, I'm your brother that you sold into Egypt. And they, of course, are frightened and things like this and wonder what he's going to do to them. But here's the idea that God had a plan in this all the time. And Joseph's going to spell that out over and again three times. God sent me before you to prepare a way. God sent me ahead of you to deliver you in this famine. Doesn't mean that God put these brothers up to their meanness now. Nothing like that. But God's going to use things like this so that Paul can say about his troubles, all these things have fallen out rather unto the furtherance of the gospel. So that Paul can say, all things work together for good to those that love God, who are the called according to his purpose. Joseph came to understand so clearly that God had a hand in permitting this to come. And I'm talking about that because people today, sometimes I hear around Bristol this expression, ah, me and my luck. No. God permits things to come that we don't understand at all. And yet God has a purpose in whatever he permits. All right, at that point, after Joseph has introduced himself to his brothers, he sends them back to get his father Jacob. He says there's still going to be years of this famine. And he says to him, see that ye fall not out by the way. He knew their temptation. They've got to go back and say, Daddy, we were the ones that sold our brother into Egypt, and now he's in charge of the country. They wouldn't be excited about getting home with that one. And Joseph says, now see to it that ye fall not out by the way. They came and said to Jacob, your son Joseph is still alive, and he's really in charge of Egypt. And it was just too good to be true. And then Jacob saw the wagons that had come. Joseph had sent these wagons, maybe they were two-wheel wagons, but they were to take Jacob and his household goods and things like that. When Jacob saw all these chariots or wagons, he believed. He looked at the evidence. Now, there are times when we ought to look at the evidence. The evidences are from fulfilled prophecy. And this is a 600 or 800 page book-length topic, but there are so many hundreds of prophecies that no man could ever have guessed. Prophecies about Babylon, about so many other cities. We ought to look at the evidence about the influence of the Bible on people's lives. And I've mentioned today the evidence of things dug up in archaeology. Evidence now, just by itself, won't make somebody a Christian. It's no substitute for a person's giving his heart to Christ or something like this. But the simple fact is, some people need to look at the evidence that is available. Years ago, there was a man in England named Sir William Ramsay that didn't believe the Bible. He decided that if he were going to prove that the Bible wasn't true, he'd better start with the book of Acts. And once he could show that Acts wasn't really true, then folks would be willing to give up the rest of the Bible. Well, he started following Paul's journeys, going from place to place. and everything checked out so perfectly that long before he got to the end of the journey, he'd become the most Bible-believing Christian they had in England in that generation. He wrote books like The Cities of St. Paul, St. Paul the Traveler, and his firm conviction grew out of simply looking at the evidence. Jacob saw these wagons, and he was convinced. And so he gets ready, and they start to Egypt. Now, before he leaves the country, in chapter 46, Jacob is going to sacrifice to the God of Isaac and Jacob at Beersheba. And God's going to appear to him and tell him that Israel will become a great nation. And there's the promise of the ultimate return from Egypt. Well, Joseph keeps track of this. And when he hears that his father's coming, he goes to meet Jacob in Goshen. And then he's going to take some of the brothers, and eventually Jacob himself, and introduce them to Pharaoh. Joseph thinks they ought to be polite to Pharaoh and courteous to Pharaoh, and he wants to protect his people from Egyptian paganism. Joseph's been down there, and he wants his people to be off by themselves. And he arranges that. We are with our families, should encourage people to be separate from what's evil in the world. Joseph was concerned about things like this. And as I've mentioned, he took these brothers and eventually Jacob himself. And Pharaoh says to Jacob, "Now, how old are you?" Now, that was a polite question to ask. Don't ask some elderly lady in this, or middle-aged lady in this country, how old she is. It's not the right thing to ask. But in some parts of the world, when you meet an old person, the courteous thing is, "Well, now tell us how old you are." And so Jacob tells him that the days of his years have been few and full of trouble. But he meets with Pharaoh. Then Jacob is going to make Joseph promise not to bury him in Egypt. This is not something trivial. This is not just sentimentality. Jacob understands about the land of promise and God's promises, and he wants to remind these children and grandchildren about them, and he says, "I want to be buried in the land of promise." And of course they did when the time came. Now, in chapter 48, there's going to be the meeting of Jacob with the grandchildren, Ephraim and Manasseh, Joseph's two sons. And Jacob's going to adopt them as his own. You know, as their grandchildren, he wants them to be numbered with his own children. So when the promised land, many years later, is divided up into 12 parts, there's going to be tribal land for Ephraim and for Manasseh. And it's going to work out right because the priestly tribe didn't get a large area. They got cities and places to live, but not a large area of land. And Jacob says, "I die. But God's going to be with you, and he's going to bring you again to the land of promise." And then there's a long section here in which Jacob, as an old man in Egypt, is going to bless not only these grandchildren, but he's going to bless all the sons of his family. And he's going to tell them things about the future. He's going to tell some of them where they'll live in days to come. In chapter 49, verse 8, there's something we should look at. He says, "Judah, Thou art he whom thy brethren shall praise. Thy hand shall be in the neck of thine enemies. And Judah's a lion's whelp. And then, verse 10, the scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver's staff from between his feet until Shiloh come. Shiloh means his whose right it is to rule. And what this means, I take it, is that the kings are going to come from the tribe of Judah, David and all of his descendants, all the way down to Christ, who was descended from the tribe of Judah. And so, here's the idea that Christ is going to be the ultimate king from the tribe of Judah. There are prophecies like this. He talks about how Joseph's going to be like a fruitful bough, and things like this. Now, Jacob is going to pass away when he's 147 years old. He'd been 17 years in Egypt, and they have what we'd call a state funeral. They take him back to the land of promise and bury him near Machpelah. And at that point, these other brothers are, in our language, scared to death. They say, now Daddy's gone, there's no telling what he'll do to us. And Joseph says to him, as for you, you thought evil against me when you sold me, but God meant it unto good. The thing we've already talked about, he said God was had a hand in this, and he's going to say, I die, but God will visit you and bring you out of this land to the land which he swore to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Here's Joseph, the man of faith. Here's Joseph. Now, Joseph didn't know the modern hymn books or something like that, but he could sing the hymns of faith. He knew how to look forward to God's tomorrow and things like this. Now, in chapter 50, there are very strict instructions that Joseph gives about the future. You see, he says, now, when I die, you're not to bury me. And that means they'd put him in a sarcophagus is the word, I think, and embalm him. And so he says, you can bury me when everybody leaves. Now, I think we talked about this once before, but the old preachers used to always refer to this as the longest sermon in the Bible. Why, it took 40 years to get this sermon preached, and it was dry as a bone, is the way they said it. You see, they carried Joseph's body all through the wilderness when they left Egypt. And it was a formal procession, and all the little children saw it and knew that Uncle Joseph believed in God's promise, and that Uncle Joseph had said, I don't want to be buried until all of God's people are leaving Egypt and on their way to the promised land. And so all during these 40 years, they carried Joseph's bones, and that means in this big box, the sarcophagus, until he was buried at Shechem. That's over in Joshua 24. All right, here's Joseph now doing a great work after his life. There are other Christians that have done that. John's disciple Polycarp has done so much since he died through his books. Luther, Calvin, John Wesley, you can name all kinds of people who've done a great work since they went to be with the Lord. Genesis now begins so wonderfully with God's creation, and it ends with Joseph unburied in a coffin in Egypt. The word Genesis again means beginning. The beginning of the universe, the beginning of the world, the beginning of life, the beginning of man, the beginning of sin, the beginning of death and evil, the beginning of weeds and briars, And it's also the beginning of the great promises about Christ. As Christians, we look not only to the end of Genesis, but we look to the book of Revelation that tells us about God's tomorrow. You see, Genesis tells us about the heaven and the earth. The last book in the Bible is going to tell us about a new heaven and a new earth. The first book in the Bible, Genesis, is going to talk about man being separated from God and driven out of the Garden of Eden because of sin. Revelation is going to talk about man in paradise forever with God. Genesis tells us about the beginning of tears and sorrow and why. And Revelation is going to talk about the time when God shall wipe away all tears from their eyes, when there shall be no more death, neither sorrow nor crying, or anything like this. Genesis begins again with this doctrine of creation, that the creation society is doing so much to promote in the last 15 years or so. Dr. Morris out in California and his son John Morris and men like Gish, who are showing that scientifically, and these are all top scientists now, but they are showing so wonderfully that science goes with Genesis. Creation tells us about what things really are. Creation again, and I just want to close with this review. Creation tells us what a man is. The details in Psalm 8, that he's made in the image of God and put in charge of God's creation. Creation tells us what plants and animals are. Creation tells us what this universe is. It's something God made. And that's why the world we live in is such a wonderful world. Thank God that He created all things so wonderfully. And may God bless you is our prayer.